Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, listeners. Before we start, just a small fun announcement. I'm excited to let you know that this episode is the first in a 4-part special series about design. It will be spaced out over the next few weeks and will include 2 bonus Wednesday episodes, so look out for them. Okay, hope you enjoy. Welcome to Life and Art from FT Weekend. I'm Lila Raptopoulos. When we think of the look of a city, most of us probably think of the skyline. But there's a whole other aesthetic world of a city that you can only see when you zoom in close. It's the design that exists in everyday objects. Lampposts, phone booths, fire hydrants, drains. Things that seem so ephemeral that we barely notice their design. There's a term for these things. They're called street furniture. And my colleague Edwin Heathcote has been studying them for a long time. Edwin has been the FT's architecture and design critic for 25 years. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. He's the author of more than a dozen books, and his work just makes the world feel a little clearer. He helps you find poetry in the mundane. Last year, he published a book on this topic called On the Street, and he's with me in the London studio to talk about how to see your city with fresh eyes. Edwin, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Hi, Lana.
Hi. Thanks for being here. So maybe we can start with the basics, which is just how would you define street furniture? Like, what qualifies?
Yeah, it's a fairly simple classification, I think. It's a layer of public amenity. Mm. You could say an infrastructure of public goods. When we think of architecture, we think of 5-story buildings or skyscrapers or whatever. It's a big scale.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the body in the city, the human body. And then this stuff is kind of at the scale of the body because it's in the street. And it's all to do with how we move through the city and how we use it. So it's that kind of mediating layer between us and the buildings.
So the in-between is the in-between us and the actual architecture of the city. Cool. So I hear that your book started as a series that you published for the FT that was quite controversial in the newsroom some years ago. Is that right? Like, why is Edwin writing about manhole covers?
I think that's right. It's a tough sell, actually, in a way, because it's boring. You know, in a way, you know, we think of manhole covers and telephone poles and booths and, you know, we don't really think about this stuff as culture.
Right.
But there was a time when it was thought of as culture and it was a part of city building. You know, my contention is that that's faded now and we don't really see this stuff anymore. We leave it to engineers to design. So it's just purely functional. It has no kind of aesthetic integrity to it, no intent to beautify the city. So really what I was trying to do was highlight this layer and see where it was done well, you know, and how it can impact the city and impact your perception of traveling through the city, of moving through the city, and, you know, where it wasn't done well and maybe whether we could do something about it.
Yeah. I'm struck by how successful that series was and how, like, exciting, actually, even though it seems boring, how exciting... readers and people who live in cities find it and found it. Why do you think this appeals to us?
I think it has a kind of universality. Yeah. So because it's at our scale in the city, we encounter these objects as equals. If you think of the phone booth, particularly London phone box, you know, the red one,
the iconic
that everyone knows exactly. It's a beautiful little temple to technology, in a way, to a new technology that was emerging. And it's designed exactly to fit our shape. You know, it's vertical like we are. So it's almost like a sentry box or a guard standing outside a palace because this little box, the booth, is a representation of the state. This was a state-owned entity, the post office at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it has to embody the values of a nation. You know, it's a lot to do for a small piece of street furniture.
That's so interesting.
And it's the same with, you know, bollards, which used to be cast iron and very carefully thought about in their shape. And whereas now everything is just, it's basically just a tube of extruded metal.
Yeah, that's true. I was going to ask you about that because there are a lot of design choices that we don't think about. And there, it seems to be a difference. There's the difference between the sort of purely functional, modernist, utilitarian designs of things, like a lamppost that just provides light. But then there's like very ornate lampposts.
Yeah.
Does that sort of trend with architecture trends over time? Like, can we kind of talk through the ornate versus the functional? How do you think about that?
Yeah, it does. So very much, if we think of Victorian architecture, you know, the Gothic, the kind of wildly overblown stuff, and then we think of the Victorian lampposts, the gas lights, they're very much part of the same world of things. They're ornate, they're trying to express some kind of identity and trying to add a kind of dignity to the street. If we look at Paris in the 1860s, when it was being redesigned by Baron Haussmann, the same architects who designed the buildings designed a range of street furniture, street lights, kiosks for selling newspapers, public fountains, and so on. And there was a whole layer of things, the Colonne Maurice, you know, these cylindrical columns that had theatre posters on and so on. And that was all conceived as a unified layer of urban identity. This was a kind of deliberate city branding gesture, in effect.
Which worked quite well, right? Like we see Paris still as the most romantic city.
Yeah, absolutely. And these small things, even though we might not notice them that much, they're a very influential part of that identity.
Yeah. And then when we think about street furniture that's meant to sort of impose control, what would be an example of that?
You know, I've suggested that these items are an infrastructure of public amenity.
Yeah.
But you could reverse that and say these things always have an element of control. They're erected by the state to regulate city life in some way.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's to our benefit, like clean drinking water from fountains in the Victorian era. But sometimes, like street lighting, it's not necessarily always so popular with the residents. So in Georgian London, when they started putting gas lights up, the sex workers, you know, for instance, well, they depended on a level of darkness for their anonymity,
right,
you know, the conduct of their trade. And the patrons of the sex workers who work across, you know, all layers of society from the bottom to the top, you know, there is a kind of a need in a city for a level of anonymity. But you know, you might argue that streetlights were to do with control. Police phone boxes were to do with control.
Right.
So these things have slightly sometimes authoritarian connotations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other kind of category about this is the street furniture that is sort of utilitarian and purely functional. And you're saying there's a lot more of that now and you wish there was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, when I was writing the book, there was a really fascinating incident. It was the pandemic time, and they were putting up the infrastructure for 5G.
Mm.
And there are these, you'll have noticed them probably, there are these very blank looking poles with a kind of a vessel on top.
Right.
Which is the transmitter.
Yeah.
And people around Britain were setting fire to these poles, which is very hard. It's a steel pole, but they were trying to set fire to these, you know, these solid steel poles, because they thought that the 5G was spreading COVID.
Oh God!
And it was a completely kind of medieval superstitious moment in which you see that these things stuck on the street can have intense symbolic value, you know, even now, symbolic and superstitious value. Something that you think would have disappeared, you know, along with a witch burning or whatever, but there, you know, here it is. So we do attach meaning to these objects that suddenly appear in our streetscape.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm curious if you could tell me a little how you notice, you know, in general, as you're walking around cities, like, how annoying are you as you're walking down the street? Are you stopping all the time to take photos?
I suppose a little, yeah. I mean, I'm probably not great to walk with, but I don't really have a hobby. So my hobby is wandering around cities, either my city, London, or other cities if I happen to be somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I spend, you know, hours walking around looking at the way people use the city.
Mm-hmm. What are you sort of looking for? How are you looking?
I think I am just looking.
Yeah.
I think that's all it is. Yeah. So it's not a specialism.
Yeah.
I suppose, you know, we all spend a lot of time walking through cities, either looking at our phone screens or with headphones on or in an Uber or, you know, a metro. So we're maybe not necessarily walking through the city as much as we should.
Yeah.
And it's when we walk through the city at different times of the day that you begin to understand how the city is used in different ways at different times. I was amazed the last time I went to Hong Kong, where I was there on a Sunday, and the Filipino nannies had taken over the kind of elevated walkways, and they were all having picnics. Sunday is their day off. They set themselves up cardboard box sort of booths almost.
Right.
And they're completely appropriating the public realm in a way that doesn't get in anyone's way, and the authorities tolerate it. And I find that very attractive. I think we have a tendency now, perhaps, to not use the city enough. We use the city for consumption.
Right.
You know, so we go out to restaurants, we go out to bars and hotels and theaters and cinemas and stuff, but we're not somehow appropriating the public space enough, with the exception maybe of parks.
Yeah, totally.
In the evening when there's no one in the city of London, wouldn't it be great if the city filled up with skateboarders, you know, grinding along the ledges?
I know. I actually think skateboarders are some of the best. They're the best examples of people who know how to use their city in a different
way. Yeah, absolutely.
Play kind of with their city.
Yeah, it's a ludic approach to the city, yeah.
Yeah. You wrote in your book that the image of cities change as they try to become more like a particular idea of themselves, which I find really interesting, but I wanted to ask you about what that means to you.
Yeah, that's something that, say, particularly applies recently to Paris, where they had this infrastructure of public goods, the newsstands and the Morris column, advertising columns, and the public toilets,
yeah,
which had all been designed as a coherent layer of things, you know, with a very specific urban branded identity, you might call it. And they've, some of those things had reached the ends of their public lives, so they needed to be changed. And they formulated a kind of pastiche of the of those things with the modern amenities, the modern tech built in. And it's an interesting thing because, you know, it's halfway between a kind of homage to a history, but then you also wonder, well, shouldn't really we be thinking about what are the new things we need in the city?
Yeah. You
know, what is that? I mean, in this country, for instance, but I know in the States too, the infrastructure of public toilets has been decimated. There's almost none left. And that is, you know, you would think an absolutely critical part of an accessible city, you know, for women with small children, for older people. If we're trying to get people to walk and exercise more, how do we allow them to stay in the public space?
Yeah, that's really true. Okay, so public toilets are one example of something that's really not working. Are there others?
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, what's known as hostile street furniture, you know, which is deterring people from, for argument's sake, sitting on a particular window ledge or making a seat at a bus shelter kind of uncomfortable so that it can't be, you can't lie down on it. And I think there is an opportunity for street furniture to be a layer of public luxury. So a park bench is the most incredible thing.
Yeah. What about things that no one notices but actually have quite interesting designs? Like I think of the drains.
Yeah.
In the city. As an example.
Yeah, well, I mean, manhole covers, coal hole covers, all these kinds of things, which are sort of flush with the paving. There's a whole language and there's a whole kind of nerdy, obsessive world, which is completely concerned with these. People, you know, collect them effectively, photograph and collect them. In Japan, there people actually collect the manhole covers themselves.
Right.
Some of them are, you know, enameled and painted and extremely ornate and designed to celebrate events, whether Tokyo Olympics or Expo or whatever they might be. And those pieces of public infrastructure, I find, are kind of lost opportunities when they don't celebrate something.
Yeah.
You know, I noticed in New York, the new sewer covers say NYC sewer. Made in India. And it's kind of interesting, you know, because it's a story of globalization and the loss of American industry, but it's also slightly depressing that no one thought, you know, maybe we could cast a pattern into this and we could do the same pattern for the whole city. It's once you do it once and then you just use the mold for all the manhole covers, but no one thought, wouldn't it be great to commission a graphic artist to do something really celebratory here?
Right. It really does take a level of creativity.
Yeah. And I think maybe we've just lost the capacity, the cities have lost the capacity to be imaginative about these things. They're so stressed and stretched and, you know, they're just trying to provide the basic minimum of social services and so on, that they haven't got time for this stuff, which actually matters.
Yeah.
Because it is very much about the pride we have in our cities. It's very much about our identity and engaging with how we live in the city.
Yeah. And why do you think, I mean, I'm sure cities have always felt stretched, but why do you think it mattered more in, say, the 1800s to these cities than it does now?
I suppose the cities were built in a different era. So they were built, let's say, between 1800 and 1950.
Mm.
And it was a moment of industrial explosion. And industry itself and manufacturing were celebrated.
Yeah.
So the fact that you could cast an iron coal hole cover was a kind of slightly extraordinary thing. You know,
before
that, it would have been wood. So this was a brand new material, and there was an experimentation in what you could do with this new material and how you could ornament it, how you could make it special. Maybe now that has been lost a little, you know. So if we look at contemporary lampposts, there's not much to celebrate in a modern lamppost generally, you know. And it's not the lack of ornamentation, it's the lack of thought.
Mm.
It's just, you know, people haven't thought about what these things could look like, what they could do for the city. You know, it's just it's the kind of cheapest possible solution. And that's, you know, it's a symptom of globalization, but it's also a symptom of kind of stupidification, actually.
Right. For listeners who want to start to notice their city differently or want to start to notice cities they go to, or just, you know, see things that maybe they're not used to seeing, how would you recommend we start to notice this in-between architecture, the things around us better?
It's a good question. I think probably the place to start in any city is the street market. You know, if you think of a fruiterer's stall, you know, outside a store in a Turkish part of London,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's a kind of wonder. These things come out every day and they, you know, they make a colorful streetscape. They're enticing, but they're beautiful and they're colorful, and then they're gone again.
Right.
There's a kind of temporary layer, which I find very seductive, actually, in all cities. And it's different in every city. Every city has its own traditions. And then immigrants arrive in the cities and bring their own traditions, mm-hmm. and they hybridize. But then always sit on a bench. Sit on a bench and see how people use the city, a bench in a park or a bench in the city, and just watch people watch. You know, it's the most kind of underrated entertainment I think we have in the contemporary city, is just watching how people move through the city and use it.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to ask you as we close out to do one quick lightning round game with me, which is that I'm going to name a city,
mm-hmm.
and I would love to hear just off the top of your head, just something that like you think we should notice in that city,
right.
or something that you think is pretty special in that city. The first one is the city that you probably know best, so I'm sure there's many. Let's start with London.
I think in London, we could start with the Embankment,
mm-hmm.
which was made as a byproduct of the underground being built underneath it. So here's a piece of brand new urban thoroughfare with the kind of grand view of the Thames.
Yeah.
And incredible streetlights cast in iron and with beautiful modeling of sea monsters and dolphins and so on.
Yeah.
The benches with camels and kind of symbols of empire. That's a very coherent piece of streetscape in London, I think. And it's very much about empire and about power and about creating a public amenity.
Yeah.
And something to be proud of.
Yeah. Okay. Singapore?
Singapore has a colonial legacy.
Mm.
And it has British street furniture, a lot of which is preserved, which is fascinating. But I think it might be the kind of hawker markets actually in Singapore, which are sort of an in-between world, in the in-between world of street furniture. But it's a public infrastructure. It's a roofed, open-air infrastructure of public commerce.
Mm-hmm.
But incredibly lively, you know. And there's this very kind of irregular but very interesting network of tables and chairs and the kind of slightly chaotic arrangement of furnitures.
Yeah. What about Rio?
Rio, you'd have to go to the beachfronts, to Copacabana and Ipanema, and
mm-hmm.
look at the paving, which is this incredible mosaic of Portuguese-influenced, actually, a black and white wavy patterns.
Yeah.
So you sometimes when you're on it, you don't notice it to its best effect, but when you see an aerial shot or you look down from one of the skyscrapers on the waterfront, you really notice it. And it's an incredible kind of undulating series of patterns, which feel free and exotic and modern. the surface that we walk on is something that's ignored.
Yeah.
Broadly. And in cities all over the world, it's ripped apart and then badly repaired. And it's just, it's not given due consideration. But where it's done well, it's spectacular.
Yeah. Amazing. Edwin, this was just blew my mind. It was just so, such a pleasure and so interesting. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks so much for your time. It was great to chat.
That's the show. Thank you for listening to Life and Art from FT Weekend. Take a read through the show notes. We have linked to some of our favorite pieces of Edwin's on street furniture, and we have linked to where you can find his book. All of our links that take you to the FT will get you past the paywall. Also in the show notes is a discount to a subscription to the Financial Times and ways that you can stay in touch with me on email and on Instagram. I love hearing from you. I am Lila Raptopoulos, and here's my brilliant team. Katya Kumkova is our senior producer. Lulu Smith is our producer. Zach St. Louis is our contributing producer. Our sound engineers are Breen Turner and Sam Javinko, with original music by Metaphor Music. Topher Forges is our executive producer, and our global head of audio is the great Cheryl Brumley. Have a lovely week, and we'll find each other again on Friday.